Hello and welcome to the 2018 Fremantle Press podcast series. My name is Caitlin Watts and today I'm joined by City of Fremantle TAG Hungerford Award winner Jay Martin. Jay's debut book, Vodka and Apple Juice, follows her journey to Poland after her husband lands a diplomatic job in Warsaw. The title of the book refers to a drink. It is a mixture of bitter and sweet, which are feelings that you struggle to find a balance between during your time in Poland.
Yeah, when people ask me, you know, what was it like living in Poland, I always say we had the best days of our lives and the worst days of our lives there, because it really was this roller coaster of, you know, really quite amazing experiences. I mean, I was living in the heart of this country, of the heart of Europe, you know, I could go anywhere from there. And that was an incredible luxury, and I never ever lost sight of that. And yet there were these days when you hadn't seen the sun for months and Tom and I were fighting, and I just thought, you know, have we actually made the biggest mistake of our lives in coming here? Because, you know, we know how it ends in the end and, you know, everything turns out fine. But it wasn't clear to me at the time that that was what was going to happen. And then in the background, you had this crazy country, which was part of what was, you know, driving me to drink in some ways, but which I also really had this love and admiration for. And this is a country that's national anthem starts, you know, we're not dead yet. And you can't sort of help but admire that spirit. And even though it wasn't my culture, it was an attitude I could relate to, and certainly one which I ended up needing to get both of us through. So when it came time to name the book, I thought, well, you know, what are things that are typically Polish and, you know, cabbage and pork, and nothing much really came to mind. But then I thought of szalotka, which is the drink that I'd had, which was made of something, you know, vodka, which I started off not particularly liking, and then something sweet, which was apple juice. And when you mix them up, you make something a little unexpectedly interesting.
So you've mentioned the drinks of Poland, but the cuisine and flavours of the Polish food were also very different to what you're used to. Namely, their love of meat left you as a vegetarian, feeling hungry and disappointed at times.
Yeah, I have to say Poland wasn't a great place for vegetarians, but I did have some amazing meals there. Certainly a lot of Polish food, very stodgy, very heavy, pork sausage, pork knuckle, pickled herring, pork fat. You know, you're probably seeing a bit of a pattern here. It goes with the climate, but yeah, it's not really that great for vegetarians. What I would say is we did get obsessed with pierogi when we first arrived. So pierogi are one of the national dishes. It's kind of a cross between ravioli and gnocchi, and they fill them with things like pork or cheese or potato. We actually ate nothing but pierogi for the first few weeks. We were so excited about them. But then we sort of had to lay off them after a while because we felt like we'd overdosed a little bit. There's another thing called placki, which is sometimes called blini in Russian, and they're potato pancakes. I have no idea what they do to make potato taste so good, but honestly, they're really, really delicious. And then an honourable mention has to go to the hot chocolate, which is like more like a chocolate mousse. It's just this thick and rich and gooey chocolate goodness, and you eat it with a spoon. And there's honestly nothing better when it's minus 20 outside. I have to say probably one thing that changed the most with my palate when I was there was actually about mushrooms. You know, it turns out there's a whole world of mushrooms out there that I didn't know anything about. There are these big flat ones that, you know, are almost like meat. And my favorite ones turned out to be these, they're called kurki, which are chanterelle mushrooms, and these small yellow nutty ones. And there's a really short season of them, and they're sold on the side of the road by little old ladies and men who've been in the forest picking them. And they're so good.
Would you like to give us a reading from your book about the mushrooms?
Sure. We sat down to eat a meal of homegrown vegetables and forest-picked mushrooms in a 110-year-old restored country farmhouse, warmed by the heat from the stove that had cooked our meal. How many people must have done this in this house over its long life? But here I was, probably the first Australian, maybe the first Australian, to have ever been to this tiny town. A few hours later, Agnieszka and I were making ourselves comfortable in the space where a barn had once been, to the side of the house. With a couple of mattresses, thick blankets, and a wall full of books, it was a cozy guest room. "Do you feel homesick for Poland still, Agnieszka, even after all these years that you've been in Australia?" I asked her. It had been more than 20 years. I fully expected that she would say no. "Oh yes," she said instead, her intensity surprising me. "It's so easy for me here. I have my parents and my friends and my language." What about you? Do you feel homesick being away from Australia? Agnieszka asked me. I shook my head. There are a few things I missed about Australia, but I didn't dwell on them. We were only going to be here for 3 years after all. I was making the most of it. Being an expat isn't like being a migrant, Agnieszka. It's just 3 years. I'll be back in Australia soon enough, I said. Oh, I nearly forgot. I brought you something, she said, fishing a small plastic bag out of her things to give to me. The drab olive of a eucalyptus branch showed through the plastic. She brought me gum leaves. I opened the bag and inhaled their scent. The smell of the hills I used to walk on after work, to the sounds of the pink and grey galahs and crimson rosellas. The smell of endless lazy hours of the summer holidays of my childhood. The smell of a place where things were easy and people were like me, where what I could say wasn't limited by vocabulary and grammar. All of a sudden, a flood of hot, heavy tears was rolling down my face, and I was powerless to stop them.
I'm sure homesickness is a feeling anyone who's travelled can relate to. In what ways did the Polish climate impact you on an emotional level?
Yeah, people comment to me a lot, you know, about Poland and the cold, especially people from Perth. Their main response when I said we were going to Poland was, isn't that cold there? But it's not really the cold that's the problem. I actually don't remember being cold that often. But it's a very dark place, and there's this constant blanket of low-hanging cloud. And honestly, the climate really does make you feel quite miserable. I remember thinking one day I felt really happy, and I was like, oh, why am I in such a good mood today? And then I realized, oh, it's sunny and there are blue skies. So it was kind of like a good day in Poland was such a rarity that I feel like I remember them all. I remember some days just sitting in my apartment and thinking I should go out. But the weather was so miserable and the people were so miserable. I just thought, oh, if one or the other were different, I could do it. But I just can't do it today. And there were many things that made sense to me about the winter there. I mean, there's Christmas. Honestly, Christmas just makes sense in Europe in a way that it doesn't make sense in Australia. There's mistletoe in the trees and there's snow everywhere. And in town, the whole city was lit up and there's all these bright twinkling lights all around. And there's this huge illuminated Christmas tree in the old town square. And then the old town have these markets, which are all lit up with all these kinds of decorations and things. And there's all these very specific Christmas foods like otsupek, which is a sheep cheese, kind of like halloumi. And they heat it up on these charcoal burners and they serve it with cranberry juice. And it's just magical.
In Poland, you really connected with your passion to write and tell stories. When was the moment you decided you wanted to tell your own story?
Honestly, I found Poland really quite fascinating from the moment that I landed. It had been an entirely unknown country to me. There was so much about it that was, you know, just interesting. So I started telling stories about it, you know, pretty much straight away. First I told, you know, just wrote Facebook notes and then I got 20 or 30 likes and I'm like, oh, that's not bad. So I got a job at the Warsaw Insider, which is kind of a what's on in Warsaw kind of mag. And I also started writing for Crikey, which is the Australian news site. And I really liked having those outlets because they gave me a reason to go and find out more about the country and then to write about it. So I went off to cover the opening of the biggest Jesus in the world, which was built when I was there in a place called Świebodzin. I went and rode on a steam train because there was a story on steam trains that I did. And people started saying, oh, you know, you should write a book. And I thought, oh, yeah, but I need something a bit more than, you know, this sort of stuff, you know, to write a book. Ultimately, you know, I think what did it or what made me a bit more inspired to do it was really the characters that I met behind the scenes of the sort of diplomatic world. There's really no way to sugarcoat this. I met some really horrible people. And I'm talking about the wives, and they were universally women, unfortunately, in Warsaw's expat scene, who really just sort of had nothing to do with their lives. And they hadn't worked in, you know, years, and they didn't really want for anything. They had every privilege in this life. And I'd never met people like this before. You know, I'd been living in the People's Republic of Canberra, so this kind of wealth and privilege was all new to me. And so I was kind of interested in what it was like to, you know, to live in that kind of world. And I came to the conclusion that it's really important to have something to do with your day. It doesn't really matter what it is. You know, you could want to write a book, you could paint a picture, you could go to work, you could look after your kids. But whatever it was, you know, you had to think that it was important and worthwhile.
So you said there that there was no way to sugarcoat some of the people that you met behind the diplomatic scenes. The author's note at the end of the book mentions the characters all have fictional names and that your book is a composite of a series of experiences you had while in Poland. How did you manage to balance fact and fiction in your writing while still adhering to the memoir genre?
I mean, I've heard some people say that they looked back on a time of chaos and complexity in life, and at the end, you know, it emerged like it had been a fully formed novel. And I have to say that my experience was nothing like that. It seemed messy and chaotic at the time, and it seemed messy and chaotic afterwards when I tried to look back and see, you know, what I could tell in terms of a story. And I kind of came up, I guess, with a couple of threads. There was Poland, the country. There was the craziness, implausibility in some ways of some of the things that happened to us. And then on the other hand, there was the troubles that Tom and I had had. But certainly there were multiple ways I felt that these events could have been merged together and to tell some kind of story. There were some things I felt like I had to keep as they were. So things that had been on the public record, for example. So Penny Wong came to the Poznan conference and Joel Fitzgibbon got hospitalised in Krakow. So these were things that I couldn't change, I felt, because, you know, they could be checked. At the time that I was there, a plane crash actually killed the president of Poland, together with about 96 or so senior Polish government officials. And I didn't feel like I could change very much about that kind of thing, not only because it was a matter of fact, but it was also a really incredibly sensitive national tragedy. So I didn't feel like I could move something like that, you know, from sort of April to December just because it was going to make more sense for the narrative. And then, you know, at the end of the day, the rest of my life wasn't that interesting. And so, you know, I had to kind of come up with, you know, a way of taking some things out. And of course, as soon as you leave one thing out, you've fictionalized the story because you've changed it. But I suppose what I'd say overall is, as I went along living this experience, there were so many times that I thought, God, this is so crazy. You know, you just couldn't write this stuff. It must be true. And I suppose what I'd say to readers is, as you're reading it, the more you think this is so crazy and implausible that, you know, it couldn't possibly be true, the more likely it is that it happened exactly like that.
So would you like to do a reading to show us just how crazy such situations could be?
Sure. This is one that it's actually about the time that Foreign Minister Stephen Smith came to Warsaw, and I ended up on the official delegation as his photographer, so I'm taking photographs. Sightseeing with the minister is not like normal sightseeing. For a start, it was conducted at high speed. We were ferried around in a cavalcade of police vehicles that zipped in and out of the traffic, sirens blaring. And the whole thing was choreographed to the last second. 15 minutes to see the field cathedral of the Polish army. Click, click. 15 minutes to lay a wreath at the Warsaw Uprising Museum. Click, click. Back in the police car, sirens on, screech off for Old Town for a 20-minute film at the Historical Museum of Warsaw, documenting in grainy footage the transformation of the city from a sunny pre-war city of mothers pushing prams to one of total post-war destruction. We emerged onto the beautiful Old Town Square, only to be directed to the storyboard showing what it had looked like at the end of the war. A grey pile of rubble amidst grey piles of rubble. Click, click. Warsaw had teamed our itinerary with a shroud of dank, low-hanging cloud that was standard for this time of year. It came between the light overcast of summer and the oppressive overcast of winter. I documented Smith's sombre contemplation of Warsaw pre- and post-war as best as I could. The minister, a shortish man with grey hair and a serious disposition, didn't say a word to me the whole time. I put it down to lack of sleep or jet lag, or perhaps he was just traumatised by the day's sightseeing program. By noon, we'd done Warsaw's highlights, such as they were, and we deposited the minister at his destination, a press briefing with the Polish Foreign Minister, Radoslaw Sikorski, at the minister's stately offices. I took a photo as evidence that the meeting had in fact happened, and Tom approached our minister, letting him know that it was time to go. All of a sudden, it was like someone had thrown a rock into a nest of policy ants. In addition to furious BlackBerry punching, there was now much pointing of fingers at watches. Tom came up to me. Get those photos back to Canberra now, won't you? Tom, the Minister for Foreign Affairs, and an intensity of policy advisers swept down the stairs of the ministry building into waiting police cars and sped off for the airport, sirens wailing. My photos appeared a few hours later on the Foreign Affairs website under the caption, Minister Smith visits Poland. I wondered if he had any idea what country he'd been in. I doubted he'd ever want to come back.
So you're just speaking of crazy and implausible happenings. I think that's a great transition to talk about Polish culture. Throughout the novel, you find it really difficult to understand their way of life. Things like the queuing process, for example, are quite different to what you're used to in Australia.
There were certainly plenty of things that didn't make a lot of sense to me about Poland at the time. I would say that we loved living in a high-density city. Warsaw is a city of 1 million people, but it takes up only a fraction of room that somewhere like Perth does. Everyone lives in apartments of sort of 35 to 50 square metres, and usually that's got their parents in them as well. So because of that, people don't really spend much time inside. You know, they're out on the streets, they're in parks, and they're in cafes. And what happens is that it becomes a very walkable kind of place. There's good public transport, and there are shops, and there are restaurants, and there are cafes. Polish people think of our lives with, you know, four bedrooms and a backyard as being so utopian, whereas I feel like they actually had a kind of amenity that, you know, we really don't have here. So we had this kind of grass is greener kind of thing going on. One thing I would say that I really struggled to understand at first was they have a real sort of tendency towards self-criticism, Polish people. So if you said something was good about Poland, they'd come back with, oh, yeah, but these 10 things are terrible. And I found this really frustrating because I think in Australia we're a country and a culture that really likes to celebrate our successes. And we're kind of, you know, taught not to dwell too much on our deficiencies. And so to me, you know, this really seemed needlessly pessimistic and critical. I was at a meeting once at the Uprising Museum where I was volunteering, and they were criticizing the meeting. And I was just thinking, why can't you people just take some pride in what you've achieved? You know, why all the criticism? And then someone stood up and said, look, I know we're being really critical here today, but let's remember, we don't criticize our children because we don't love them. We criticize them because we do love them and we want them to be better. We want them to aspire to more. And I felt like it all just kind of fell into place for me then. Certainly it's one thing that I've seen since I've come back to Australia is this sort of culture of, you know, near enough is good enough and a bit of complacency. That's nice on the one hand, but I wonder if it serves us well, because I think sometimes that we don't always feel inspired to do better. It was actually interesting because at the end I wrote at the book about things that I reflected on that I saw differently about Australia for having been away. And I actually written about the value of, you know, being more self-critical because it could actually inspire us to do better. But then I, funnily enough, I ended up taking it out because I thought people would take offense because they thought it was too critical of them. So I guess that kind of proves my point.
You also face some very difficult and dark times during your days in Poland. There are moments when you're in a lot of pain, but you feel almost guilty because you think, oh, well, anyone would love to have this free and adventurous life. How do you combat the struggle between what you are feeling and what you think you should be feeling?
I remember just before we left Australia, my husband Tom said to me, you know, do you think you'll actually miss work when you don't have to go anymore? And I actually literally was rolling around the floor laughing at the ridiculous of that suggestion. I had this incredibly stressful and demanding job, and the idea that, you know, I would miss that just seemed so ridiculous because I was just so excited to go to Poland and to leave all of that behind. And I suppose what I'd say is that I was really surprised at how quickly what he actually said came true. I honestly think it was barely even a week before I started to think like, well, what's kind of my place in this new world? How am I going to define myself? What I did see, though, is I saw it for what it was. And while it was a lot harder than I expected, I think I was sort of able to avoid the fate of becoming one of those wives who just kind of, you know, champagned for breakfast. Because I did actually understand, or I saw what I was grappling with. To the point where I actually was offered a job in the end, but I ended up turning it down because I actually did understand that the problem wasn't that I wasn't working. The problem was how I felt about not working, and that if I was going to just solve that problem by going back to work and giving up all of the great things that I did have in Poland, you know, that was actually probably a pretty dumb idea. So, you know, I decided to just try to get on with it, experience living in Poland and do a bit of writing and do all those things that I wanted to do. And of course, I'm really glad that I did that. And I really believe in writing as therapy, you know, and I believe in the power of stories to change lives.
Well, you just moved to Canada for your work, so perhaps that would make a great second book.
Yeah, or perhaps that's my third book then. we used to laugh that, you know, in Polish, there's no way to say to look forward to something, you know, which seemed to me to say everything that you needed to know about Polish culture. You know, they had these other really perfect Polish sayings, like they have a saying, nie mój cyrk, nie moja małpa, not my circus, not my monkeys, that means. And to me, you know, it just so perfectly encapsulates the concept of, you know, there's someone stupid doing something stupid, just let them get on with it, you know, don't engage with it.
Well, thank you, Jay, for chatting with us today. Jay's book, Vodka and Apple Juice, is a funny and insightful read. I highly recommend you get your hands on a copy to learn all about Poland through the lens of a diplomatic wife. It's available in all good bookstores and online at www.fremantlepress.com.au.